This is One-on-One with Mark Monti on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. And Dr. Gary Walton, dentistry with a personal touch.
He's one half of the most famous set of twins in the history of basketball. Inspired by their literal courtside seat for Milan High School's historic state championship win and by the brilliance of Oscar Robertson, he and his brother went on to become co-Mr. Basketballs and All-Americans at Indiana University, and then went on to play 12 seasons in the NBA. Now, more than 20 years past his retirement, he still holds an NBA record that's less than desirable. But he did distinguish himself as a solid player who performed well for six teams and averaged more than 15 points for his career. Since then, he's engaged in a variety of business interests and made several trips abroad, including one hilariously ill-fated fishing trip to Russia with Bob Knight. Then and now, the prototype of the All-American boy, he remains one of Indiana's most unique and successful athletes. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Tom Van Arsdale. Welcome to One-on-One. This is Mark Monteith. We're spending this hour with another Hoosier legend, Tom Van Arsdale, one of the Van Arsdale twins who gained fame at Manual High School, Indiana University, and in the NBA. Tom, let's start with your beginnings in basketball. You are from Greenwood. You attended Manual High School, but you're from Greenwood. But as a youngster, what lit the spark for basketball for you?
Well, my brother and I started watching the state final tournaments in the early 50s, and that's when television was kind of just getting started. And we used to watch, the first guy I remember is Joe Sexton for Indianapolis Tech. And then we would watch, of course, the Attucks teams. And we always watched the IU teams with Don Schlunt, Bobby Leonard, Farley, Kroc, and all those guys. And so we became enamored with Indiana basketball, mainly from watching those guys on television.
Mm-hmm. What was the first state finals that you attended?
Well, when Dick and I were 11 years old, it was in 1954, and our dad was a coach and a math teacher at Manual High School in Indianapolis, and one of the things he did during the tournament was take tickets for the championship series out at Butler Fieldhouse, which is now Hinkle Fieldhouse. And so we were sitting on the floor watching Bobby Plump and the Milan team play in the finals. And it was really, really kind of amazing that when we watched that movie Hoosiers, which everybody has watched, I'm sure, we were sitting on the edge of the floor because Butler has a raised floor, and our dad took tickets right down there in one of the corners of the field house. And so my brother and I got to sit right on the edge of the floor, and when Plump hit that jump shot to win the game, we were right in line with his jump shot when it went into the basket.
That's so amazing.
It was really amazing, yeah.
I'm sure you've seen clips of Plump hitting that shot. Can you see yourself on it anywhere?
No, I saw it recently on an internet show, and I looked, and I couldn't see Dick and me, but I guarantee you, we were there.
You're sitting right literally on the edge of the floor, and not up in a seat, but on the floor itself.
No, we're literally sitting on the floor. I'm sure today you couldn't do that because security is so much different than it was then. But we were sitting on the edge of the floor, not knowing that, you know, so many years later we'd be participating in that final game also.
Yeah, so how big of a deal was it for you that Milan won that state championship? I mean, the whole small school thing, was that a big deal at the time?
Maybe we were too young to realize the importance of that. I mean, we just were enamored with Indiana basketball. And, of course, we loved the Terre Haute-Gershmeyer teams when Howard Sharp was coaching Harley Arley and Harold Andrews, because the identical twins, and Harold was the third guy. And my brother and I would stand at those Gershmeyer games because they went to the Final Four, and we would wave it at the twins, and, you know, because we were twins. And, so, you know, we just had a tremendous history and feeling for those games.
Yeah.
And of course, and then when addicts started becoming prevalent, we were just in awe.
Did you go to those games as well? Did you see Oscar in person in the state finals?
I don't think I saw Oscar at the state finals in person. I saw it on television, but I saw him his senior year when he was running track in the down at the Bloomington Fieldhouse in the Hoosier Relays, and I went up and asked him for his autograph and got it. Got his autograph then.
Do you still have it?
So I still have it, yeah.
What about that Manuel Kokomo final in 1961? It was a classic game. It's overtime. It was the first overtime game in the state final since 1918. You guys led by 7 points with 1:07 left. You fouled out with 2:54 left. And then this, for to summarize it, Ron Hughes from Kokomo drew a foul with 3 seconds to go and hit both free throws, and those were the game-winning points for Kokomo in overtime. Now, Kokomo had a great team. They were 28-1 that season. They had Ron Hughes, who went to Purdue. They had Jim Ligon, who played in the ABA. But what are your memories of that game? I know it had to be a crushing defeat at that time.
Well, I'll tell you, Mark, it's a small world. I have become very good friends with Babe Pryor, who was on that starting team for Kokomo. He and I become very good friends, and another guy on that team was Dave Cox, who now lives in Tulsa, and we have communicated. And Goose Ligon, who was on that team, was living in Louisville, Kentucky, and got very ill. And it just, you know, the camaraderie that develops in those relationships over the years is really kind of inspiring, because we heard, my brother and I heard, that Goose Ligon was having problems in Louisville, and we called him and talked to him and helped him out a little bit. And, you know, here's a guy that beat us in a championship game, and here's a guy, Babe Pryor, who beat us in a championship game. And we have become very good friends lately. I mean, it's kind of ironic. But what I remember is that when I took the floor that night in that championship game, I really thought it was surreal. Like, what am I doing here? I've always wanted to be here. I always wanted to get one of these championship rings, and here we are playing in this game. So
yeah. Sold out Hink Butler Fieldhouse.
Yeah, I mean, every time my brother and I try to get back to Indiana once a year, and we always go out to Butler Fieldhouse or Hinkle Fieldhouse and go in there. There's always a way to get in. We go in there. The aura is still there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of ghosts in that building.
You bet.
But the game itself, did you feel like you had it won when you're up 7 with 1 minute to go?
Hey, Mark, let me tell you something. We got screwed.
I've heard that before from Manuel people.
Well, I hope Babe's listening to this, or Dave Cox, or Joe Platt's not here any longer. But, you know, Richie Scott and Ronnie Hughes and all those guys, I mean, they had a really good team, and we had a good team, and you know, I give them credit. They won. They deserve it. You know, you can always cry foul play, but hey, I've learned over the years, that's the way it goes, and you either win or you lose, and if you lose, you lose. So I'm just happy we got there. I think the older we all get as players who went through that, the more we appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No question. But did something in particular happen in that game? When you say you got screwed, what happened that you thought was wrong?
Oh, gosh. I just remember, and, you know, of course, I was on the bench because I fouled out.
Yeah.
There was a foul call that I thought was just very, very questionable. But those guys, they were good. They had a great team. And, you know, you look at the play. Goose was a heck of a player.
Oh, yeah.
Richie Scott was a heck of a player. Ronnie Hughes. Babe Pryor's a heck of an athlete. And Dave Cox. And they had a good team. So.
Did you feel like the foul on Hughes that put him on the line for the game-winning points was a bad call? Was that the one that you questioned? Or
yeah, I thought it was a bad call. Yeah.
Okay.
But who? You know what? Hey, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
So what was your reaction, though, at that time? How tough was it to live with that for a while? You know, what did you do when you got home that night and so on and so forth?
Well, you know, here, that's an interesting question, Mark, because my brother and I always knew we wanted to go further, and so we were very disappointed, but we also knew that that was not the end, that we were going to go to Indiana and play, and then we both wanted to play professionally. So, you know, when those things happen, those roadblocks happen, I mean, you just say, well, hey, that's over. Let's keep going. So that's what we did. I mean, we were disappointed, but, you know, we weren't depressed or anything like that.
The Venarsdale Twins are named Mr. Basketball and pick a college. when One-on-One continues. We're back on One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, and this week we're talking with Tom Van Arsdale, half of the most famous set of twins in basketball. Tom, the next thing up for you and Dick was the All-Star Series with Kentucky. You are co-Mr. Basketballs, naturally, and you played in that series against Kentucky. Now, typical for identical twins, you had identical stats in that series. In the game in Louisville, the first game, you both had 26 points, and you guys won. Now, you had to take six more shots to get your 26 points than Dick did, but we'll let that slide by.
Yeah, I always took more shots than he did anyway.
And what was weird is that you both got 26 points, and Dick was named the Star of Stars. He got the MVP of the game award when your stats were identical.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, he got lucky.
Is that
I never
something
let him live that down.
He kidding you about that?
You know what? We never had any jealousy between the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
We never did. You know, the first time, and we'll probably get into the NBA careers, but
yeah.
The first time he made the NBA All-Star team, I hadn't made it yet, and I was so happy for him. I was so happy. So we never had any animosity about things like that.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, he got that Star of Stars. From what I read, there were boos because people thought you should have gotten it with him. But you come back to Indianapolis for Game 2 of that All-Star Series. There's a record crowd of 15,134 fans out at Butler. To give people an idea of what this All-Star Series used to be for Mr. Basketballs, you know, in the 1960s, they would fill up Butler for this for these games. You know, now they're lucky to get 5,000 fans out there, but
they had
a sellout crowd at Butler. And after scoring, after both of you scored 26 points in the first game, you both scored 14 points in the second game back in Indianapolis. Now, you lost that game 78-75, but you went through that All-Star Series with identical stats, which happened a lot with you guys, it seemed like.
Yeah, you know, people will ask us about our statistics and who was better. Was Dick better or was I better? And if statistics are any indication, I mean, there wasn't much difference. And I'm still amazed because in college we finished with, you know, over 3 years of playing 12 points apart
total.
And in the NBA, we were really close. So I just think we had pretty equal abilities, and it just worked out. And it's pretty phenomenal.
It is. It's really weird. We'll talk more about that later. But the recruiting process, had you made up your mind by the time you finished your high school career that you were going to Indiana, or was it still left open?
No. We had made up our mind. We went to visit Purdue because we felt we should. And we visited Butler because we felt we should. And we talked about Wabash because our dad went to Wabash. And so we told Dad we would go over to Wabash. But we knew, you know, we had Adolph Rupp came up from Kentucky and Vic Bubas came up. And we had guys come up. But we knew we wanted to go play for IU and Branch McCracken.
Because you had grown up watching them on television?
Yeah. You know, the Indiana teams, when they won the NCAA tournament in 1953 with Schlunt and Leonard and Kroc and Farley and Scott and all those guys. I mean, we watched every one of those games. We listened to them on radio if they were out of town, and we actually kept score of what each one of the guys was scoring. I mean, we were joined at the hip with those guys.
Yeah, so you're keeping a scorebook, huh, at home?
Yeah, we would sit at home and put an X for a field goal and 1 point for a free throw, so we knew exactly how many points Don Schlunt scored or
yeah.
How many, you know, we back then, of course, nobody kept assists, but we knew what everybody was doing and followed them closely.
What was it like playing for McCracken? He won national championships in 1940 and 53. By the time you get there, he's at the end of his coaching career. In fact, your senior year was his last season as IU's coach in 1965. What was that experience like for you?
Mark, I can tell you've done your homework.
I have.
You're doing a good job. Yeah, good. See, one of the things is, which a lot of people forget, when we went to Indiana, the first 3 years of our four-year career down there, Indiana was on probation, couldn't play in any tournaments because they had gotten an NCAA sanction because of football recruiting violations.
That's right, like in 1961 or something like that, they had a football problem.
Yeah, so we couldn't play in any tournaments until our senior year. So the senior year, finally, we could play, and we played the Memphis Classic, and we won that, and then See, back then you had to win the Big Ten Conference to play in the NCAA tournament. So we finished, obviously, you'll ask about the Michigan game. We got beaten by Michigan, so we never got to play in an NCAA tournament.
Was that the game where you're up 7 with like 2 minutes to go and lose it? That's kind of a replay of your state championship game, wasn't it?
No, it really is, and I fouled out again. And Dick and I and John McLaughlin are very good. We're like brothers.
Right. McLaughlin's also on that IU team.
Yeah, and the three of us roomed together at the SAE house at Indiana for 4 years, and we played together, and we're, to this day, we're like brothers.
Yeah.
And we still talk about the fact that here the three of us played. We all think we were better pro players than we were college players.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow we got better as we got older. But we should have won the Big Ten. I mean, but that year there were four Big Ten teams that were ranked in the top ten: Michigan, Illinois, Minnesota, and us. And so you had to win the Big Ten to go to the tournament, and we never got in it.
Michigan went, didn't they?
Michigan went
with Cassie Russell and those guys.
Cassie, Bill Bunton, Trigoning, Darden, and those guys, and yeah.
Hey, that's sports.
That's sports. That's right.
It sounds like it must have been an idyllic time here. You're a college All-American. You and your twin brother are down at IU. Your basketball stars. Your academic All-Americans. It sounds like it was a dream world, but I don't know. I'm sure you have fond memories of it. But what was it like being at IU in the early mid '60s at that time?
Well, what I remember, Mark, is that we all put too much pressure on ourselves.
Mm.
I mean, you know, here you are. You're playing, and you know what basketball is like in Indiana. And we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. I think we disappointed ourselves in college. I mean, we didn't win the Big Ten championship. We didn't go to the NCAA tournament. Our junior year, we didn't have a good year. I think we disappointed ourselves. When I look back, I think, man, it could have been should have been better, and it wasn't. Having said that, what we got out of our college experience was, we developed so many friendships in our fraternity house, people that we're still friends with in Bloomington, ex-teammates, and those mean a lot today. But had it not been for the pro careers, I think I would have been very disappointed. That summer, Dick and I were on the world team that went to Europe and played, and we met Billy Cunningham and Bill Bradley and Lou Hudson and Ollie Johnson and other guys who went on and played in the NBA, and we did win. That's the only time we won a world championship or any kind of a championship. We beat the Russians in the final game over in Budapest, 81-36, and it was a wonderful feeling. Never had that feeling any other place.
That's right.
Won another championship.
Yeah, that's right. That's your only championship, isn't it?
Yeah.
The draft in 1965, the NBA draft, there's only eight NBA teams at this time, I believe.
I think there were either eight or nine. I can't remember which.
All right, and they have a territorial draft then, so three players go in the territorial part of the draft, and then eight players go in the first round, and then Dick goes, not counting the territorial players, Dick goes 10th overall to New York, and you go 11th to Detroit.
Yeah.
I'm just curious now, is Dick giving you a hard time about going ahead of you, and how could a team have picked one of you over the other? I mean, how do you decide between the two?
You know what? I think New York was dumb.
<There you go. laughs> Because, I mean, really, you're so identical. They probably flipped a coin to decide which of the Bernarsdales to take.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what – I think Harry Gallatin was coaching the New York Knickerbockers at that time, and I think Dick McGuire was one of the scouts. DeBuscher was in Detroit. I don't know how they made the distinction, but we were happy to go to different teams because I think one of the things that we had all along was there was always the two of us, and people would say, the only way you guys are making it is because you're twins. There were a lot of people who didn't think we were going to make it in the pros. So when we went different ways, I think it was good for us.
I was going to ask you about that, if it was strange being apart, because from what I understand, you guys were always together.
We were, and it was strange, but we also knew that for us to make a pro team, if we were on the same team, we'd be fighting against each other for a position. So we wanted to go separate ways.
So when you're separate like that, do you talk every day, or, I mean, was the relationship like that?
It was. I mean, we would talk almost every day. I mean, and then once we got in the, we made it and got in the games, we'd call each other every day.
And you had to change positions, didn't you? Didn't you have to go from like a forward to a guard type of position, or
yes,
you had a difficult adjustment up there?
Well, it was. I wasn't a very good ball handler. That wasn't one of my strong points, and it was difficult. But I think the thing Dick and I had going for us is we were strong, and we were fast, and we were quick, and we were aggressive. And, you know, you look at some of these guys, like, let's just say a Rick Mount or a Steve Alford or some of these guys who are Damon Bailey, who are mm-hmm. good college players, and they get to the pros, and for some reason they don't make it. I think one of the things is they can't get their own shots.
Yeah.
They're not strong. They're not quick enough. Or whatever reason it is, they don't have what it takes to be a pro. Well, I think Dick and I had it.
You were athletes, yeah.
Yeah, and we had it. And John McLaughlin, made it. And so we talk about this quite frequently. How does a guy like, you know, Rick Mount not do much in the pros? And how does a guy like Jimmy Rail not do much in the pros? And how does a guy like, Steve Alford not do much? These guys were absolutely phenomenal college players.
Yeah.
But you see it happen all the time. I mean, you see these guys who they kind of are protected in the college game, and then when they get to the pros, they're not protected anymore, and they can't, for some reason, can't take care of themselves.
Did you and Dick play other sports in high school besides basketball?
Yes, we played. We loved track, so we ran track in high school, played baseball. We played freshman football. So track is actually our favorite sport.
What events?
We ran the high hurdles, the low hurdles, put the shot, high jumped, and ran on the half-mile relay team.
Wow. Did you have a lot of success? I mean, were you setting school records or anything like that?
Yeah, I set the school record in the high jump, and Dick probably could have won the state high hurdles, and he tripped on a hurdle at Tech High School and fell down. But we were good hurdlers, pretty good high jumpers. We had pretty good speed. I mean, not class speed, you know. For basketball players, we had speed. In fact, we were looked at by Gil Brand of the Dallas Cowboys. He came to Indiana and timed us in the 40-yard dash because at that time, the NFL was starting to look at basketball players to be football players.
So did they invite you down for a tryout to the Cowboys? Or
they, you know, I can't remember. Gil Brand to this day, I mean, we know Gil Brand. He's famous in Dallas. He came in time. I don't know if we officially got an invitation to go or not.
How high did you jump in high school?
I jumped 6'4.5".
Oh, that's good.
Well, that was, you know, they didn't know what the Fosbury flop was then.
Exactly. You're probably jumping in sawdust, too. My brother graduated from high school in 63, and he jumped in sawdust instead of foam rubber.
Well, you know what? That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, we did the roll. We didn't do the Fosbury flop.
Right. Then, you did a Western roll or something.
That's right.
And you landed in a sawdust pit.
That's right. That's right.
The Venarsdales turn pro when one-on-one continues.
Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. This week's guest is Tom Venarsdale. Tom, you had a 12-year NBA career, but 2 years into that career, both you and Dick were contacted by the Indiana Pacers. They're forming in 1967, and they had this kind of dream of putting together this Indiana All-Star team. They talked to Oscar Robertson about being a player coach. They talked to you and Dick about playing. They talked to McLaughlin about playing. They talked to Terry Dischinger about playing for them. Did you have any interest at all about joining the Pacers then?
I got a call from Mike Storn, who was the general manager of the Pacers. Tom, and I was playing for the Cincinnati Royals at that time. He said, Tom, we'd like to talk to you about playing for the Pacers. So I got in the car and drove over, sat down with Mike Storn. And I don't remember if Slick was involved then or not.
No, not then.
Not then, okay. But anyway, they were just kind of embryonic in the ABA in their stage of growth. And Dick and I always wanted to, now I don't want to sound rude, but we always wanted to play with the best. And we always felt that the ABA at the time in our career was not the best. But having said that, I was interested to hear what they would pay. Obviously, you're going to see, well, are they going to pay you more money to play in the ABA than they are to play in the NBA? And what I found out was Indiana was not willing to pay enough, seriously, even to get me to think about moving. So I never even considered it.
Do you even recall what you were making in Cincinnati at that time in 1967?
I was probably making, let's see, I'm going to say somewhere between $25,000 and $50,000 a year.
Yeah, I'd say if you were making $25,000, then you were doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, really, in 1967, that was a good salary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I got drafted by the Pistons, I think I made $13,000. You know, guys were graduating from Stanford in the MBA program making $9,000.
Oh, sure.
So I said, hey, that's not bad. I'm making $13,000. Somebody that gets an MBA at Stanford's making $9,000. So I was happy.
Oh, yeah. No, that was fine back then.
Yeah.
Now, one of the unfortunate things about your playing career is that you hold the distinction.
I know exactly where I'm going.
And you have played more games and scored more points than any player in league history who never played in the playoffs. I mean, you had the misfortune of always being stuck on weak teams.
I'm very proud of that.
Are you?
I am. I'm very proud. People kind of are embarrassed to say, Tom, did you know you have a record? I said, yes, I'll tell you why I'm proud of it, Mark. Because we didn't have free agency back then. So when you got on a team that was bad, you were stuck. And you couldn't say, okay, I'm going to opt out of this and go to somebody that's – I couldn't go to the New York Knicks with Dave DeBuscher and Willis Reed and Bill Bradley and Walt Frea. You know, I couldn't do that. So what I'm proud of is that I hung in there and played hard for every team no matter how bad we were. And I scored a lot of points, you know, and have the record. So I'm proud of it.
Yeah. Well, you played 12 seasons. You played for Detroit, Cincinnati, KCO, Omaha,
right,
Philadelphia, Atlanta, and then you finished up in Phoenix with Dick.
Right.
And you averaged 15.3 points for your career. For a couple of seasons in Cincinnati, you averaged almost 23 points a game.
Right.
So you had a lot of success, obviously. And if you had been on a good team, you know, you would have been in the playoffs. It wasn't like you were holding anyone back.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously that's a career to be proud of.
Well, the thing is, Mark, back then, you know, when Dick and I came into the league, we were playing in the Eastern Conference, and Philadelphia had Will Chamberlain, and Boston had Russell. And you had to finish in the top two to make the playoffs. Well, that was almost impossible.
Yeah.
And I was, and you know, when I got traded from Detroit to Cincinnati, then I started in the backcourt with Oscar. And here's Oscar. Oscar is, to this day, still my idol. This guy was unbelievable, and he couldn't get in the playoffs.
Right, that's right.
So until he went to Milwaukee and had Jabbar, he never won a world championship.
That's right.
So the competition back then, when you have Russell and Chamberlain, and then you got Casey Jones, you got Heinsohn, you got Havlicek, you got, you know, and then Philadelphia has Luke Jackson, Chet Walker, Billy Cunningham, Hal Greer. I mean, how do you beat those guys out of the playoffs?
Right.
It's almost impossible. So I never was on a team that the best record we ever had was in Cincinnati when we finished 500. So, you know what? There you go. What are you going to do?
Let's talk about the twins thing with you and Dick. I mean, you know, you're identical twins, and as we mentioned, your stats were often eerily alike. You had identical scoring games in the Indiana-Kentucky All-Star Series. At Indiana, you scored 12 more points than Dick over your three-year career there. You averaged 17.4 points. He averaged 17.2. You shot slightly better from the field. He shot better from the foul line. Then in the NBA, you both play 12 seasons. You average 15.3 points. He averages 16.4. You played only 8 more games over 12 years. You almost played an identical number of games. Dick had the advantage, or not maybe just a good fortune. He only played for 2 teams, New York, and then he was an original Phoenix Sun and played the rest of his career there. You know, obviously, I mean, you're twins, so you're a lot alike physically. Could you even differentiate between you two as players? Did one of you do something better than the other? Was one of you better than the other?
There is a differentiation. Dick took it to the hole more than I did, and I took jumpers more than he did. So that was a difference. Jerry West used to say that Dick was one of the toughest guys that ever guarded him. So I think Dick might have been a little bit better defensive player. But other than that, it's pretty close.
It'd have to be, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to write a book about my mother years ago, and I had this one sheet I was putting in there to show the statistics of Dick and me, and I was making correlation between some of the childhood stuff. But anyway, I was just amazed. I look at these statistics today, and I said, how can this be? We're just so much alike. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Did you two go one-on-one a lot against one another?
We did when we were little kids. We played a lot of one-on-one against each other in the backyard, and we fought continuously, which is not unusual for brothers, but it helped us hone our games, and we were extremely, you know, competitive.
Did one of you have the advantage in those one-on-one games, or did you each
no,
win the same number market. Of games?
It just depended on who was madder. It was kind of brutal. It was really brutal. But, you know, once we got into high school, that all changed because then you kind of reach a level where pull for each other. And so we didn't have any problems after we got to high school.
Yeah. Now, did you guys do any of the standard twin jokes, you know, switching places in class or on dates or anything like that? Or were you ever tempted to switch jerseys in a game, that type of thing?
We played in 2 NBA All-Star games on the opposite sides, and everybody always wanted us to change jerseys. And we thought about doing it, and we never did. We should have done it, but we had some fun times with dates and things like that. And Dick was a little bit better in English in his curriculum studies, and I was a little bit better in math. And so we'd help each other a little bit there, but for the most part, you know, we didn't do much switching or anything like that.
Did you ever take tests for one another?
We never did that. No,
didn't go that far.
And it's hard to fool girls too, because they're extremely discerning. We would sometimes try to switch dates, and they could tell.
Really?
Yeah, they could tell.
You couldn't get away with anything, huh?
No.
Do you two have a connection where you kind of know what one another are thinking, or can you be in a different state and kind of know what's going on with the other guy? I mean, does it ever get to that point?
Well, I know exactly what his reaction would be to a certain situation. So if you tell me something's going on, I know what his feeling would be. I mean, people have asked us, do we feel each other's pain? No, we don't. But if we're to, you know, twins have a language. In fact, my wife talks about this. When Dick and I are together, we can be talking to each other and saying things, and we can short-circuit it because he knows what I'm going to say, and I know what he's going to say.
So you have your own language.
Yeah, and the problem with that is, in the business world, sometimes I can be talking to somebody, and I don't finish what I'm saying because of my habit of talking to Dick. Because he knows what I'm thinking and what I'm going to say. So my wife Kathy will say, Tom, you didn't finish your thought process, or you didn't finish your statement, and that's because I'm a twin. So I have to be real careful about that. I have to be real careful about how I continue my explanation process.
What was it like that last year when you played together in Phoenix? You finished your career with the Suns, the 12th season of your NBA careers, your teammates then. That must have been a great experience to go out that way.
We had so much fun, and I was so excited to be with the Suns because they had played the year before against the Boston Celtics in the World Championships in 1976, and they almost pulled it off, and they didn't. So when I got traded to Phoenix the next year, I thought, finally, my chance has come where I can be on a playoff team. And I was like in my 12th year, and I wanted to play like 15, 20 minutes in a backup role. Well, three of the starters from the previous year got hurt. Alvin Adams, Garfield Hurd, and Curtis Perry all got injured. So I had to start most of the year, and we didn't make the playoffs. So again, my chance of making the playoffs was thwarted. But having said that, we had a great coach in John McLeod. He's a Hoosier, and we got along great. And Dick and I would room together on the road. So we really had a good time.
Tom Vinarsdale discusses his twin brother's stroke and goes salmon fishing with Bob Knight. Kind of. When one-on-one continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. This is Mark Monteith. And this week's guest is former Mr. Basketball and Indiana University All-American Tom Vinarsdale. Now don't forget, all the episodes of One-on-One can be heard via podcast on our website by going to 1070thefan.com and clicking on the One-on-One tab. Now, Tom, I wanted to ask you about the stroke Dick suffered about 2.5 years ago. You two are obviously so much alike genetically. So when he goes through something like that, does that give you concern?
Well, you know what? He had a atrial fibrillation. He was getting that flutter in his heart. And so he was on Coumadin, which is a blood thinner. And then he had elective surgery. And during that elective surgery, he had a blood clot break loose from the upper chamber of his heart and go to his brain, and that's when he had the stroke.
Okay.
And I've never had that fibrillation. I know Jerry West has had it. I think maybe Bird might have had
it. Oh, yeah, Bird has it. A lot of pro basketball players have had heart issues.
Yeah.
You know, Ron Artest had heart surgery when he played for the Pacers in the offseason once.
Okay,
and
yeah,
a bunch of bigger guys.
It's amazing. And I know that Gail Goodrich has had it. They call Dick, and so these guys have it. I haven't had it yet. So I'm not really worried, but Dick is, you know, it really affected about half of his brain, his cognitive skills. He didn't have any physical impairment, but he's doing fine. He comes into the office and sits. We've got an office where his desk is beside my desk, and he comes in and he doesn't do any business stuff. I do it for both of us, but my son has come in to help, and so he comes in and we have a good time. And as long as we can fly fish, and as long as I hope Bob Knight hears this, because we are better fly fishermen than Bob Knight, and we're better golfers. So as long as we can do that, hey, we're fine.
Okay. Well, I talked to Dick not too long ago, and he sounded good. Occasionally he kind of used the wrong word in his conversation. He'd get things a little bit jumbled, but otherwise he sounded good. So he must be doing pretty well.
You know what he is? He does, though. If people will say, well, there's nothing wrong with him. But when you're with him all the time, he has trouble with numbers and he has trouble with names. But for the most part, he's pretty darn good.
I'd like to go back and ask about when your formative years of basketball. Where did you guys play growing up? I mean, not just when at Manual High School, but, you know, I talked to Gary Donahue, who's a good friend of yours. He says you guys played at Meadowood and Speedway quite a bit. He recalled the time, in fact, when you guys always showed up together, and one time only one of you got out of the car and the other had gone to the airport, and it just kind of stunned everybody because they were so used to seeing you together that to see one of you was kind of eerie for them all. So
Dick and I used to go. We used to be able to get into Cathedral High School's gymnasium, and we'd go up there in the summer after we worked in the summer, and then we'd go up and play against. There was a real good player that played at Shortridge. I think his name was Ron Thomas. And we'd go up there and we'd play with Ron and Gary and Dick and me and some other guys. And then Dick and I started going up to the Fall Creek YMCA up on Indiana Avenue in where all the Attics guys played.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the greatest things we ever did. Willie Gardner was up there.
Ooh,
and all those old Attics guys. And that was when we were the only two white guys going up there to play. And those guys were so nice to us. A lot of those old Attics guys, when I go back to Indianapolis now and I see them, these guys are, I think it's Ray Crow did a great job with those guys. And they are gentlemen, all of them. And there was a guy named Bobby Edmonds. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, Bobby Joe Edmonds. He played for the first Pacers team, yeah.
Yeah, Bobby Joe Edmonds. I don't know where he is now.
He's passed away.
He did?
Yeah, it's been a while, yeah. Yeah.
You know, Dick and I were so appreciative of being able to go up there and play with those guys because it was extremely competitive. And Hallie Bryant's a dear friend of ours. Hallie used to live in spent a lot of time in Phoenix. Now he still lives in Indianapolis, but you know, Hal played at IU, and then he was a Globetrotter for years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Willie Gardner was a true gentleman. We loved Willie.
Yeah. Well, he's one of the great lost stories. I mean, he had a heart issue. If not for that, he might have been a Hall of Famer. I mean, he was such a great player.
He was fantastic.
What are the stories you like to tell, either from your college career or NBA career? Just the funny things, weird things that happen, that when you get together with friends, anything that stands out?
I've got some stories I can't tell you.
Oh, come on.
I wish I could. I mean, you know, gosh, I had so many good memories of I think I was a second-year player with the Pistons, and Terry Dischinger was always – I always thought Terry was just a great player
in
college.
And he was a rookie of the year despite playing only home games.
Yeah, and he and I roomed together during camp one year for the Pistons, and Terry and I became very good friends. And I just remember – because he was always kind of a very – he's almost like a ballerina when he plays. I mean, his moves were so smooth, and the way he would do his pivots – and his touch and everything. And in the pro game, after the first couple of years, then he took a little hiatus, came back. He wasn't quite the same. But I just remember he would get these blisters on his feet. And in training camp, I would be his roommate. I would get him at night, and he'd say, Tom, could you put some salve on my feet? So I would get his feet up, and I'd start rubbing his toes and the blisters with his salve. And I thought, my God, here's a guy I idolized. You know, I watched him play at Purdue. He ran the high hurdles, and he was a very good high hurdler. And here I am putting salve on his feet.
That's kind of weird.
I thought that. I remember little things like that.
Yeah.
And then one year I roomed with I became very good friends with Jerry Lucas. And
from
Jerry,
Ohio State, three-time All-American.
Yeah, and Jerry was a phenomenal player. We would ride to the airport together to go to a road game or something. And he'd say, Tom, said, do you know how many stripes there are in the highway, median stripes there are in the highway for every mile we drive? I said, no, Jerry. And he'd tell me.
He's the math whiz. He's the guy who counts everything, right?
Unbelievable. And then we'd have a meeting someplace. We were good at losing money in restaurant deals. So we were visiting somebody at a meeting one time, and the acoustical tile ceilings in the office, he'd look up and he'd say, Tom, see those squares up in the ceiling? I said, yeah. He said, do you see those dots in the squares? And I said, yeah. He said, do you know how many dots there are in every acoustical tile ceiling? Tile? I said, no. And he'd tell me. Now, that was weird.
Yeah, he discounted everything, huh?
And, yeah, and then he was so strong. And he'd get a little wild sometimes, and we were coming back from a think we were playing in Baltimore, and we got beat, and we're walking back to the room, and we're ready to go in the door, and he takes his fist, and he just pulls back and jams. He hit his fist into the, and it was not a solid core door. It was like a double layer, you know, door, but they're still hard. They're still hard. Put his fist entirely through that door.
Ooh.
And I thought, oh, my God, he was so strong. And then I got to room with Oscar, and I just loved Oscar. You know, Oscar was just, to me, you know how it is when you've got an idol when you're younger, and you idolize him, and then you meet him, and you get to know him really well, and you say, well, I don't really, my mind has changed about this guy. You know, he's not who I thought he was.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt that way with Oscar.
Oh, that's good.
To this day, I still idolize him.
Do you talk with him much?
I probably talk to him twice a year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then he's really good about calling my brother and saying, Dick, how are you doing? How are you doing? How, you know, he's just, everybody thinks he's kind of, you know.
People think that he's a bitter guy now.
Well,
that's what I hear from people, because he talks about the way addicts was treated when they won the state title and that kind of thing. So he's, people say, oh, Oscar Robertson's bitter. But obviously people who know him know a different Oscar Robertson.
Well, you know, I think he does have some bitterness in him, but when you really know, he's a wonderful guy. And it's the same thing about Bob Knight. You know, some people say he's a jerk, and you know, but then get to know him. He took us on a fishing trip to Russia about 10 years ago. There were about 12 of us who went on this fishing trip,
uh-huh.
And he set the whole thing up, set the whole fishing trip up, and it was expensive. You know, we flew into St. Petersburg, and then we went up to Murmansk, and then we took helicopters up to the Bering Strait and fished for salmon. It was the salmon run, and he set the whole thing up. We get up there, and the Russian guides that we had said, what are you guys doing up here? The salmon run is over.
So what did you do?
So we spent $10,000 apiece to go on this thing. And my brother, we're up there for a week fishing. My brother doesn't catch one fish. I caught two. So, you know, and I felt badly for Bob, but we're staying at these like wooden shacks out by the river, and every night we'd go into camp to have dinner. And so one night we're going in to have dinner, and we're all standing around there, and nobody caught any fish.
Hey, thanks, and Coach Knight.
And so I'm standing behind Knight, and his pants are kind of down. He's cut one of those plumber cracks kind of sticking out his underpants. So I grabbed his underpants, and I pulled up on him and gave him a Snuggie. You know what a Snuggie
yeah,
is?
Yeah, yeah.
And
a
you know
wedgie.
What? And, you know, most people wouldn't do that. He he turned around and looked at me, and I said, hey, everything's okay. Don't worry. He kind of got a smile on his face because he was feeling the pressure of taking us all over there and not catching any fish.
And I bet you still let him hear about it.
Oh, God, yes. And, you know, I love him. He's a dear friend. My mother, when he married Karen Knight, he got divorced and he remarried Karen. And my mother was the only person at his wedding other than the judge, than the preacher. So it was Bob and Karen, my mom, and the preacher. And she, if anybody ever said anything bad about Bob Knight in front of my mother, look out. She knocked the heck out of him.
So Coach Knight's timing on the fishing trip wasn't too good.
I don't think he was real happy about it.
Well, what did you guys do to fill your time? Did you still tried to fish, I guess, huh?
We fished. We'd fish. You know, your arm would get tired from throwing out those streamers, and, you know, you never caught a fish. And, then Bob does not drink.
Right.
So we'd go back to camp, and a bunch of us, we'd have to have a few glasses of wine just to relax. And Bob, he would fish till the sun went down trying to catch fish because he was so upset about it.
Did he ever catch anything?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Well, he said he did. Now, I don't know if he did or not, but he said he did.
But needless to say, you guys weren't eating too much salmon on that trip.
No, 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 no. We weren't eating. I think we were eating cold cuts.
One-on-One returns in a moment. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Tom Van Arsdale. I've talked to both him and twin brother Dick on the telephone, and believe me, you can't tell them apart. In fact, I'll just have to take Tom's word for it that we weren't really talking with Dick. Next week, I'll continue the conversations with former Mr. Basketballs when I spend an hour with a splendid splinter, Jimmy Rail. He was Mr. Basketball 50 years ago,
and a teammate of the Vinaresdales for one season at IU. They were just breaking in while he was setting all kinds of scoring records for the Hoosiers, some of which still stand. And remember, all the episodes of One-on-One can be heard on our website at 1070thefan.com.